Black Angus came to be really dominant. And our guest for that program, the second hour show, is M.R. Montgomery, and he has written a book entitled A Cow's Life, The Surprising History of Cattle and How the Black Angus Came to Be Home on the Range. That's the program for this morning, so we hope that you will stick around.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Christie Clinic Association, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and Mahomet. Christie Clinic, medicine for your life.
This is Focus 580. Glad to have you with us this morning. My name is David Inge. In this first part of the program, we'll be talking about movies, and particularly about blockbuster movies, as I mentioned a moment ago. And again, the guest for the show is Tom Schoen. He grew up in England. He was, between 1994 and 1999, the film critic of the London Sunday Times. He has also written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, The London Daily Telegraph, and Vogue, and now makes his home in Brooklyn. And his first book has come out fairly recently, and it's titled Blockbuster, How Hollywood Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Summer. It's published by Free Press. As we talk this morning with Tom Schoen, of course, questions are welcome. You want to talk about movies? That's great. It doesn't necessarily have to be about blockbusters, but that's kind of what we'll be concentrating on this morning. If you'd like to call in, the numbers are the same as always. If you're here in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. No one will expect you to pledge if you're calling into the program. Now, we hope that you will do that. We'd really like to hear from people this morning. Your support of this show is very important, just as it is with everything else we do here on WILL. So if you're not a financial supporter of the station, we'd really like to hear from you. But if you want to call in this program, just use the regular number. You'll come right here to the show, and you'll have an opportunity to talk with our guest, Tom Schoen. Mr. Schoen, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Not at all.
I certainly appreciate it. First, I guess, a definition. If we use that word blockbuster, I'm sure that people will think of maybe some recent one or maybe a classic, a blockbuster that was a favorite movie. But, you know, one can apply that term to a wide range of films.
Sure.
So how exactly does one define blockbuster?
Well, I mean, the first thing to do is recognize that the definition has changed a bit. Up until the 70s, you know, when people referred to a blockbuster movie, it was just purely a financial term. You know, it was any movie that had, you know, scored big at the box office. And it was kind of basically a term conferred by the audience. You know, so Sound of Music was a blockbuster. Kramer versus Kramer was a blockbuster. Star Wars, Jaws, they were blockbusters. But with Jaws and Star Wars, what happened was it actually began to signify a type of movie. It wasn't just a financial term, but like almost a kind of genre. You know, something released in the summer, aimed at the sort of, you know, younger crowd, 18 to 25 year old males, is the studio's kind of holy grail. You know, crammed with special effects and action sequences, and duly hyped as a blockbuster. You know, so even before it's out of the gate, the studio will refer to its kind of crop of summer blockbusters. So now it's not a term, you know, conferred by the audience, but by the studios themselves.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting. You have two lists here in the book of 50 blockbusters defined by their box office, how much money they made. And on the first list, they're the movies that you would expect, and they're contemporary action special effects movie. The number one is Titanic, and then we also have things like The Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter and Star Wars and Jurassic Park and so forth. And then, interestingly enough, though, there's another list, and this is top 50 all-time box office blockbusters adjusted for inflation. And that's really fascinating because there, the number one movie is, get ready for it, Gone with the Wind. And it also includes these other movies, but in addition, it includes the kind of movies that you mentioned, like The Sound of Music and Dr. Zhivago and 101 Dalmatians and Ben-Hur and The Sting and The Graduate and The Godfather and Thunderball and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and Love Story and Cleopatra and Goldfinger and American Graffiti and Around the World in 80 Days. movies that were big movies that were very popular that a lot of people went to see, but it might not come to mind immediately when we use that word, because what people will think about is, as you say, what the blockbuster movie has become.
Yeah. I mean, I really like that second list. I mean, when you read the first list, you get vaguely depressed and you think, oh, God, nobody's got attention spans beyond the last 5 years, because every movie in it is something released, you know, just yesterday. And they're all those kind of teen sci-fi, you know, sort of films. And you sort of think, oh, my God, Hollywood's going to the dogs, just like everyone says it is. But then you look at the second list and you think, well, no, actually, you know, the public has some taste. You know, that's an accurate reflection of kind of, you know, the esteem in which those movies are held. And you see that, Star Wars and Jaws, although they have their place in that list, they don't completely dominate it. And as you say, Gone with the Wind is still there at the top, you know, the number one sort of box office, you know, kind of blockbuster. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, it's kind of reassuring in a way. I think we're so used to hearing that, you know, that popular success is a mirage, and that, you know, anything that scores big at the box office must therefore suck. And then you look at that list and you sort of think, oh, no, these are films that have earned their place in people's hearts.
Yeah, I do think it's kind of interesting that Gone with the Wind is the only movie on this list that was made before 1940.
Yeah.
And that there are no silent movies. I was talking about this with my wife last night, and she sort of said, well, what about Charlie Chaplin, for example? I don't know. Do we not have the kind of numbers, or was the movie-going audience not that big? Or?
Yeah. I mean, partly it's just a matter of records. You know, box office records were not sort of, you know, they weren't kept all that accurately. So, you know, for instance, one thing that's missing from that list is, you know, the Birth of a Nation, D.W. Griffith's great sort of, you know, the first blockbuster, essentially. But there were just sort of, you know, the records from that time just are too skimpy, and it's difficult to pull together. But I think it also reflects, you know, the facts, and that, you know, Gone with the Wind, you know, was essentially the kind of the first, you know, kind of huge kind of across the board sort of hit. Thanks, you know, partly to the fact that it was re-released in sort of successive years, sort of on its anniversary and so on, and that helped sort of buoy it up. You know, kind of repeat viewings, films that we go back to again and again are the kind of key to blockbuster success, at least real success. I mean, now we sort of see things that are sort of propelled up to the number one spot on the back of one successful weekend. But, you know, that it's a slightly illusory picture. The real kind of key to it people that, you know, films that people will go back to. And that's kind of what the second list tells us.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point, too. It's something that I know many years ago, one of the things I learned, we have a fellow here who's a professor of cinema studies who's occasionally on the program, and we chat now and again about movies. And that was one of the things I remembered a long time ago, him saying, he said, if a movie's going to make a lot of money, you have to somehow get people to go back and see it more than once.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of where Jaws and Star Wars scored so heavily, because they were incredibly exciting, visceral experiences that you just went back to again and again. I mean, particularly with Star Wars, which moved so fast and was full of so many fabulous things that you'd never seen before on screen. But it moved so quickly that, at least if you're a sort of teenage boy, as I was at the time, the only way to kind of get the most out of it was to sort of see it, you know, 10 times, you know, which is kind of what I did. I mean, and it's partly down to the way that kind of teenagers kind of watch movies. Like, you know, so 9 to 5 was a big hit in 1981, you know, but Dolly Parton fans just kind of went home thinking, you know, that was a good movie. You know, I can remember going home from Superman and thinking that was a good movie, but only after I'd seen it 10 times and bought the pajama kit and bought the poster just to try, you know, just to test it, you know. We sort of laid siege to them as much as we sort of watched them.
Yeah. Well, that gets to another interesting point. Again, this is something that I was talking about with my wife last night when we were talking about the book, and I sort of made this point that, you know, a lot of people criticize what's coming out of Hollywood these days because they say that Hollywood is consumed with capturing a tiny slice of the movie audience, which nowadays seem to be the big movie goers, and they're teenagers. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, she thought, though, that still the movie might be the only popular culture item left where it was possible, and it may not happen with every movie, but it's possible that you could get an entire family together, you know, grandparents, parents, kids, little kids, and you actually could still find some movies that everybody could be happy sitting down to watch. And she said, and I think maybe that might be right, that there may not be much else yet in the world that has that kind of ability to reach across generations.
Yeah, I mean, it's sure. I think that's true. I think nowadays it tends to be the kind of kids' movies, by not the teenage movies, but things like kind of Finding Nemo and The Incredibles. Mm. I think those kind of get large kind of family audiences. I mean, you know, I'm sort of well used now to finding that those sort of Pixar movies are some of the kind of best adult entertainment around. I mean, they're just so well scripted. But yeah, I mean, it's you still get this kind of across the board hits, and you also, but it's also become a lot more kind of specialized. So each market has their own sort of particular niche. I mean, it's also true that the sort of teenage dollar is of sort of paramount importance. And you know, it wasn't until the 70s that the studios really realized this. Basically, the habit of going to the movies sort of every week, which is kind of what people did when they went, when audiences went to see Gone with the Wind, you know, it was part of a kind of a weekly sort of ritual. You would go to the movies and you would see what was on, you know, almost like we treat the TV now. And cinema going was at its height, you know, sort of back in the sort of 30s and 40s, when movies sort of had this kind of captive audience, essentially. And that's been in decline ever since. You know, like TV has had a sort of big impact on sort of audience figures, and they've basically gone down sort of with every successive year. And the only thing to halt it was in the 70s with Jaws and Star Wars, and the studios found that the last remaining audience, so to speak, the one they could hang on to, were teenagers, and so they just radically reorientated their industry kind of around that audience. And of course, that sort of leads to sort of complaints that, you know, the only movies sort of made are for kids and so on. But it's not the whole picture, because there's overflow. You know, if a studio is feeling rich from its blockbuster, it'll feel safe enough to take more of a gamble on you know, some smaller sort of independent movie. So the blockbuster that you see on Saturday has, in some, you know, in some ways, financed the small indie movie that you see on Tuesday evening. So there's a kind of relation, there's a kind of ecosystem at work, and it's very rare that you'll find a movie these days, even the smaller, teeny little art house ones, that hasn't in some way been touched by kind of blockbuster dollars. It tends to get sort of forgotten a bit.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Tom Schoen. He was, for a number of years, film critic of the London Sunday Times, and now lives in the United States and has written for a number of publications, including The New Yorker and The New York Times. His new book, his first, is titled Blockbuster, How Hollywood Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Summer, which was kind of about the golden, some people I'm sure would consider to be the golden age of the blockbuster, starting with Jaws and going through movies like Star Wars and Close Encounters and Blade Runner and Alien, movies like that. And also in the book contains some conversations that he has had with some of the people who were the directors of these movies, people like Steven Spielberg and James Cameron and Ridley Scott and others. The book is published by the Free Press. It's in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. And we, of course, would welcome your calls. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And we do have someone on that line to talk with, someone listening this morning in Indiana on line 4. Hello.
Hello. Since you more or less opened the door by that second column and using the inflationary characteristics of the movies to sequence them from one on, you know, I was wondering if anybody has ever done anything like the movies that the blockbuster movies, however you define them, analyze them in terms of the largest amount of special effects, what that does for its sequence in the column, or a particular director or a particular production group, or
right,
even a particular, though there's not too many companies left now, but something along those lines, something more sociological than, gee whiz, I'm 12 years old and I've got almost 10 years, to maybe 15 years of watching wonderful movies mm-hmm. before I have to do something else.
Well, I mean, I haven't actually conducted anything like that, but just generally, you can see certain names reoccur. You know, if you look at the list, you know, Disney have a kind of big showing. So do the James Bond movies. In terms of the directors, the names that sort of come up again and again are Spielberg, George Lucas, James Cameron, Robert Zemeckis, who just did Polar Express and did Back to the Future. There were sort of four or five kind of, you know, blockbuster auteurs, you know, guys who've kind of got the kind of golden touch. And then apart from that, it sort of tends to be the, you know, things that have just been pushed in there. You know, Cecil B. DeMille has a sort of few showings. But yeah, I mean, you're right also in that there's a large preponderance of sort of big special effects laden movies. There's something about the sheer spectacle of going to see those things that sort of encourages kind of mass sort of, you know, mass audiences to kind of congregate on them. Funny enough, you see very few kind of comedies in there. The comedies you do see are things like kind of Ghostbusters or Back to the Future, which have like a kind of special effects kind of component. But there's something about those kind of big, slightly humorless epics that that really kind of draws us in. But yeah, in terms of the other kind of breakdowns you can sort of do on the list, I mean, I think it's largely, as you say, it's the big special effects vehicles like Lord of the Rings that score most heavily.
It's interesting. You look at some of these movies you see it is possible, and maybe it's more likely if you look at the blockbusters of recent years to make a movie like this without big movie stars. Mm-hmm. Now, some people who performed in some of those movies went on to become big movie
right.
stars, but they weren't big movie stars when they started. And however, of course, some of the classic blockbusters mm-hmm. did indeed have people who even then were big movie stars. And how does the fact that you have somebody who's a big star and who you would expect to generate uh-huh. box office just because of their name, how does that go into the mix?
It's a really good question because it's sort of a little bit up in the air as to how much of an impact it has. I mean, one of the kind of key things about Jaws and Star Wars when they appeared is that they were effectively without stars. You know, in the 70s, the formula had been with movies like The Towering Inferno and The Poseidon Adventure. You know, you take a big natural disaster and you top load it with as many A-list names as you possibly can, from Paul Newman to Fred Astaire. And it sort of lent those pictures a slightly kind of heavy feel. You kind of knew who would survive. It was always going to be, you know, the A-list stars, with maybe one sacrificing himself, like Charlton Heston at the end of Earthquake. But what Spielberg did with Jaws is that he populated it with people whose faces you sort of knew and could identify with, but they weren't necessarily big household names, Roy Scheider and Richard Dreyfuss. And he told Roy Scheider, you know, I don't want to ever believe that you could kill that shark. In other words, like, you cast sort of, stars slightly lower down the list, and it kind of increased the suspense because you weren't sure who was going to survive. And the same with Alien. You know, Sigourney Weaver wasn't a big star when they made it. And she was the least likely to succeed in that movie. You didn't really have her pegged as the one who would make it to the final reel. And so the earliest, you know, the early kind of summer blockbusters, when it got started, you know, relied very much on not having big star names in them. But gradually the stars returned. You know, there was the big influx of kind of 80s action heroes, you know, starting with kind of Raiders of the Lost Ark. Although it's important to remember that, like, kind of Harrison Ford was not a big star at that point. You know, he'd been in Star Wars, but he'd made a couple of sort of duff movies since. And so Raiders sort of established him. You know, Bruce Willis, Arnold Schwarzenegger, they all kind of started to return, you know. So the stars kind of regained their kind of foothold in the summer blockbuster as the 80s kind of wore on. Mm-hmm. But it's still a slightly kind of, you know, volatile mix. You know, did Keanu Reeves make The Matrix a success? it's kind of doubtful. I mean, he certainly was, you know, perfect for that movie, but really it was the special effects of that movie that he kind of plays second fiddle to. And sometimes, you know, stars just get propelled into the stratosphere by virtue of the movie to which they're attached. It's the other way around. You know, Keanu Reeves was suddenly hot as a result of The Matrix, but, you know, he was very much kind of catching a lift off it, one feels.
Yeah. Well, are these movies where the effects are supreme, or do we say that still they're in the service of the story? So really what it is a movie that's a thing that's kind of a pure storytelling mm-hmm. medium.
Well, I mean, I think it is. I mean, first thing to say is, I mean, I'm a big fan of special effects. I mean, I'm sort of, you know, the cinema when it started was very much about sort of spectacle and putting on sights that, you know, people had never seen before. You know, when the first Nickelodeon started up, it was very much on that sort of very sensationalistic level that they worked. You know, but on the other hand, you know, it's all too easy to sort of name the pictures we've seen recently where they've kind of completely overridden the storyline. And it's a rare director that can handle effects. And it tends to be, weirdly, the guys who have had a kind of tutelage in the lower budget, down and dirty end of movie making. So James Cameron, who, you know, had huge success on the back of the Terminator movies and Titanic, you know, started out making kind of models, you know, for Roger Corman's workshop. And the Terminator emerged from very much from that kind of low budget end of movie making. And the same with Peter Jackson, the guy, the Lord of the Rings. You know, he was schooled in all these kind of, you know, sort of small B movie horror flicks. And I don't know quite why that should be, but I think it's something to do with like learning to, you know, watch your kind of purse strings. I mean, they tend to be very economical with the way they use effects as a result. So when you then hand them $600 million to go and shoot Lord of the Rings, they don't completely lose their head. Whereas some of the guys who have come along, and that's almost their first point of entry into like movie making, is a huge $100 million movie. They're the guys who get sucked under a little bit, and the effects book reign supreme. I guess I'm thinking in particular of things like kind of Independence Day and Godzilla. You know, where, you know, the guys that made that were a little bit sort of, you know, green and fresh to that amount of money. And therefore, you know, the money ended up winning.
Yeah, I guess my favorite example of that would be The Fifth Element.
Right, exactly.
And that also makes me wonder about even some of the directors you've talked about, the people who really were journeymen and who worked their way up and then managed, in some cases, against all odds, to do a very successful movie of this kind. And then based on that success, then they got the blank check. So
right.
You wonder, now, okay, what happens even with somebody like that when they get the blank
check?
Well,
that's true enough. I mean, you know, the Wachowski brothers who did The Matrix are a good example of that, because they had that blank check for the sequels and they sort of screwed those up royally. You know, and even James Cameron, you know, had his wobble, you know, back in 1989 with The Abyss. Although it's, you know, it bears up pretty well today, actually. I've got to say, whenever it's on TV, I'll always sort of watch it. But, yeah, I mean, it's true. The moment they kind of get a free hand, they tend to sort of turn in a clunker. And Spielberg, too, you know, the forgotten film in his filmography is 1941, the huge spectacular that he sort of followed up Close Encounters with, this kind of giant World War II farce that kind of got completely out of hand. You know, and he said, you know, that I by the 50th day, I felt like the movie was directing me rather than the other way around. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, he kind of recovered. And, you know, he's a very good sort of listener to what the box office tells him. So if a movie fails, he sort of listens and takes it on board. And so you have this kind of development in his career whereby he makes Jaws and he makes Close Encounters. On the back of that, he overreaches himself and fails with 1941. So therefore, he scales everything back down again and makes Raiders of the Lost Ark and then E.T. And Raiders, although it's a big success, is essentially quite a small movie and it's a low budgeted one. You know, that kind of conversation that goes on between an audience and a filmmaker is, I think, a little bit rarer today. Like, because the box office is so distorted by various different things. You know, like, you know, the Matrix sequels made more money than the original. You know, like, even though nobody would say, not even the most diehard fan, that they were in any way superior to the original movie. So what kind of message is that sending the directors of these movies if the movies that they make that are inferior are actually being judged kind of greater? You know, the box office figures have, in a sense, been corrupted a little bit. The information that filmmakers are getting back from the audience are not quite as reliable as it used to be.
Well, and that's also an whole interesting area of the accounting techniques of the movie business. You never—it's very difficult to know things like how much did a movie cost,
right?
And how do you figure its profits? And because there are so many different ways that movies now make money, and it's not just and how much money people are willing to pay up front to go down to the theater and see the movie.
Yeah, I mean, if the studio is doing its job, the most profitable movie of the year will show up in the red for them. You know, so even though there's vast amounts of money kind of funneling through the thing and going off to, you know, X, Y, and Z, it technically looks as if it hasn't made any money, which is good from their point of view. So Batman, for instance, is a really good example of that, which sort of several years in was still showing up in the red. But the accounting of sort of movies is a very kind of dark sort of science. Now we're into this sort of slightly crazy realm whereby, movies like, Men in Black 2 had to, because there was so much of its profits going out to the various participants in it, the director, the stars, you know, it actually had to make over $200 million before Sony, the studio, would even start to make money on it. You know, like, it actually had to break records in order to even break even. You know, it's kind of crazy. There's the profit margins on them are so slim, particularly with, let's say, a sequel to a successful film, which is really expected to work. Everybody knows it's going to work, and so they carve out these huge sort of profit participations in the movie. And it ends up like making very little as a result. It's a little bit like the kind of the Indians one reads about who learned how to kind of to skin and fillet an ox to within an inch of its, you know, so that every bit of the ox was completely used, you know, from its skin to its hide to its muscle. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how the blockbuster is for the studios.
Something that I think is really interesting in the book, when you think about some of these directors and now how influential they are, how powerful they are, how much money they have made, and they're considered to be, at least in terms of the box office, very important. People like Spielberg and James Cameron and Robert Zemeckis and George Lucas, how difficult it was for them when they were starting out and when they were making that first movie, which for them was the breakout movie. And it wasn't easy. And there were parts which I'm sure they thought they might not even be able to finish, or they wondered, you know, it's hard to believe that they might think of a movie like that, like Star Wars. They might ask their question of themselves, has this movie ruined me even before it's open?
Oh, yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, the Star Wars, you know, the marketing department of Fox had sort of come down with this judgment that said any movie with Star and Wars in the title is just dead at the box office. And they'd fought, you know, Lucas every inch of the way, the plug was, you know, almost pulled on it, as it was, you know, with Jaws. And it's the same with The Terminator, which was a terrific battle to get that movie made. And Back to the Future, it's one of the kind of great ironies of all these kind of by now very successful film franchises, that the first movie, in the sequence was, you know, as hard to make as, you know, the most sort of precious art house offering of some of the kind of, you know, the more respected directors like Scorsese, you know. So Lucas had to fight for Star Wars just as much as Scorsese had to fight for Taxi Driver. I think it shows too, because one of the great things about these movies, if the director has to fight for the movie, you know, it generally means there's kind of fight in the picture. You know, like Star Wars is just such a kind of great, you know, kind of combative kind of war picture. And that kind of goes out of all the, you know, you watch the prequels and all the fight seems to have been sucked out of the Star Wars sort of sequence. You know, it's, there are no clear enemies, there's no, so, you know, but back when Star Wars was being made, you know, it had that kind of, you know, up and atom kind of energy about it, which I think is very much to do with Lucas's own energy as a young filmmaker trying to make his name. You know, and the same with Spielberg. So yeah, I mean, it's funny. Like they, you know, the Terminator was the rights to the Terminator were sold for to Galen Hurd, James Cameron's producer, for $1. You know, which is quite a bargain given, you know, what the Terminator then turned into.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it does. I guess it reinforces the idea, and this is not a particularly profound sort of generalization, but that people in the movie business—that is, the people who run the studios and who make decisions about what movies are made and what movies aren't—they're pretty risk averse. They don't like taking chances, and whether that's taking chances with an art film or taking chances with a film that's really pitched toward a big general audience, it doesn't matter. In anything that seems to take a chance to them, it sounds like it makes them really uneasy.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, Peter Guber, the producer of Batman, sort of put it like this. He said to me that the cost of making these great behemoth movies is so great that essentially the studios are not really in the business of making movies. They're in the business of coming up with good reasons not to make movies. You know, essentially the process is one of kind of profound inertia. You know, like the movies get made, which the studio can come up with no good reason not to make. You know, and they spend an awful lot of time trying to come up with reasons not to make them. And in order to get that green light is a kind of incredibly kind of lengthy process in which you have to sort of persuade them by means of, you know, the stars involved or the director or the amount of special effects or the merchandising deals that, in fact, they're onto a sure thing. You know, and you know, to an extent, they've, you know, it kind of worked. I mean, the number of summers that come by and, you know, all these sort of sure things, you know, come in and they scoop up the amount of money they were supposed to on that opening weekend and then they disappear. You know, I mean, the system kind of works in a depressing kind of way. The studios can be fairly certain that Men in Black 2 will make the amount it will and that Julie does, along with all the other kind of blockbusters that summer. But very few of them seem to sort of get a sort of place in, you know, in people's hearts. In other words, it's kind of wall-to-wall blockbusters, but very few hits, which is a strange kind of topsy-turvy, you know, place to be.
Yeah. The past few years, the box office take has continued to go up, but we're told that the reason is not because more and more people are going to the movies, but because the ticket prices keep going up.
Yeah,
and actually,
exactly.
The number of people who are going actually has declined. Does one explain that simply by saying that there are not enough good movies, or is there something else that's going on?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, the decline of there are year by year fluctuations in sort of audience levels, which it's very difficult to work out sort of, you know, quite what's behind that. Often it is the kind of quality of the movies, or, you know, it might be some other factor, you know. It's curious. The studios kind of want, you know, as many as people as possible, but the number of the actual audience they're aiming for is finite. You know, it remains roughly the same. So in terms of the kind of the box office records that you hear being broken all the time, it's really worthwhile taking into account inflation. Everybody kind of politely forgets about inflation every time they sort of say, you know, this movie X has gone through the roof and broken all opening weekend records. Well, you know, that's because, you know, the dollar has risen in value and because ticket prices have gone up. And the same with kind of all the sort of number one hit movies that you hear about. I mean, there are so many number one hit movies in any given year that it's kind of hard to find a movie that hasn't been number one at some point, simply because they now process through that number one position so quickly. You know, something will open, it'll be number one for a weekend, and then it'll take its bow and it'll make way for the next movie, which is also number one for the next weekend. So it's become like a meaningless kind of accolade, you know, but, you know, Hollywood sort of lives on hype, you know, as much sort of the internal hype of, you know, being able to boast about having a number one movie. And so it sort of, you know, it carries on. But I mean, the genuine hits still come through. But now they have to sort of get somewhere in the 400 million mark. I mean, inconceivable amounts of money. You know, Jaws was like the first movie to break the back of 100 million, and that was considered like the sound barrier. You know, like the barrier that nobody believed would ever be broken. And now, you know, a semi-successful, you know, summer blockbuster takes in 200 million, like Men in Black 2, but a real success has to kind of get in excess of 400 million. I mean, incredible amounts of money, but they don't really necessarily relate to how much a kind of movie is loved by the public. I mean, oftentimes, you know, we'll all go along to see a movie on that first weekend, if only just to see that, you know, it's as bad as everyone says it is, and just out of curiosity, see what all the fuss is about, which is a very different thing from the way that movies used to open, and then spread by kind of word of mouth. And so by the fourth or fifth week, if people were still in theaters, it was generally because that movie was pretty well loved. You know, that's something, again, if you look at all the kind of earlier blockbusters, Raiders of the Lost Ark, E.T., they all stuck around for a hell of a long time, like 9 or 10 weeks. Whereas now they're just sort of up and gone in a couple of weekends.
We're down to the point here. We just have a couple of minutes now left, and I know we got to let you go just a little bit early. Maybe just as a final question, I know that there are a lot of people who would make the argument that they think that the blockbuster wrecked Hollywood, that it was the worst thing that ever happened. And I think your take on it is really different, at least if you look at what was going on at the time of the first contemporary, sort of the first modern blockbuster, which a lot of people would say would be Jaws, and then some of the movies we talked about afterwards. I think your take on it is a little bit different.
Well, there's two arguments, one of which I don't think is ever going to really get settled, which is the kind of aesthetics of it. You know, like, you know, two... the audience who are reared on sort of movies like Chinatown and Mean Streets and so on, you know, Jaws and Star Wars must have seemed like abhorrent plastic kind of toy town kind of movies that appeared from nowhere. I think it's a generational thing. You know, I on the contrary, kind of grew up with those movies. You know, I kind of lived for the next Spielberg and Lucas movie and was there first night on Raiders of the Lost Ark and sort of grew up with them and, you know, have enormous kind of affection for the part they played in my kind of, you know, cinematic kind of upbringing. So, you know, that argument I don't think is ever going to get solved, although, you know, Spielberg and Lucas are a lot closer to kind of the way that the movie business started. I mean, they're in the great tradition of filmmakers like Griffith and Hawks and Hitchcock, and that kind of great sort of narrative tradition. But then there's the financial argument, which is that they... you know, these blockbusters came along and sort of sucked the life out of you know, the rest of the movie-making kind of world so that only these big giants could live. And I'm not so sure, certainly it worked out like that, because what happened, you know, as I mentioned, was that, you know, the money from these things ended up finding its way back into, you know, the kind of indie boom of the 90s. And there was this kind of, you basically now have this system whereby what we have is big movies on the one hand, like Finding Nemo or whatever, and The Incredibles, and then on the other hand, you have the kind of smaller independent movies like Sideways or Mystic River, and that system to me seems to work. I mean, as long as you've got those two strands, you've got a fairly kind of healthy opposition, you know, between those two things. What's disappeared, I think, is the sort of middle, sort of ranking movie. You don't see so much these days of that sort of slightly kind of middle brow, middle sort of market movie like Ordinary People, which, you know, Robert Redford's movie of 1980, On Golden Pond, Driving Miss Daisy, those things tend to appear. It's that sort of middle band that's been eliminated. You know, I'll sort of leave that to your listeners to decide how much they miss On Golden Pond. But, you know, it's the system that we have now, I think, actually works pretty well.
Well, we're going to have to stop there. And, Tom, I really appreciate you talking with us this morning. Maybe on another day we could talk again.
Absolutely. Thanks very much for having me.
Well, thank you. Tom Schoen, he was a former film critic of the London Sunday Times. That was from 1994 to 1999. He now lives in the United States. He has written for a number of publications, among them The New Yorker, The New York Times, Vogue. He's now making his home in Brooklyn, and his first book is Blockbuster, How Hollywood Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Summer. It's published by Free Press. We're now going to take the opportunity to encourage you to call in and support this strange art form that we call public radio. Jack Brighton is with us in the studio, and also out in Pledge Central, Tom Rogers, our news director, and we can talk with him too. And I'm really actually glad that we have a little bit of time here, because one of the things that Jack, I know, wanted to have a chance to chat a little bit about was something that's going on the web side of things here. He is, as people probably know, he still continues to host Now and Again Focus, was the producer of this program for a long time, and then went on, and he is now heads up our web operations and looking for different ways to use the internet to bring what we do to people.
Absolutely.
And perhaps also now there are a lot of people who are taking advantage of the web archives that we have.
We hope so.
So you can listen to past programs. But we do have something really new that we're offering to folks.
Well, right. And before I mention what's up, let me just mention the phone number, because we do want people to pick up their telephone and give us a call on our pledge line, 217-244-9455. This is one of those weeks where we are coming to you. We really need your support because, you know, federal funding, state funding, university funding are all in decline. We know our listenership is growing, so we need to bring more people into the Friends of WILL, and this is a our pitch to you. Please pick up the telephone and make a pledge, 217-244-9455. And also on our website, let us not forget to mention the web address, because you can make a pledge online with a credit card instantly on a secure server. That's WILL.UIUC.edu. There's a pledge link on the top of every single web page on our site, so we hope you will use that. And, you know, speaking of the streaming service, we stream live in Real Audio, Windows Media, and also QuickTime. We added the QuickTime stream over the past couple months, and a lot of people are using that. We also have been putting our archives up since 1998, actually, on the website, so people can time shift their listening. They can go back and listen to Focus 580 anytime they want. And about 6 months ago, we started offering MP3 downloads on the site of every show that we do, so people can actually put them on their computer and listen to them on their iPod or whatever device they have, their portable device at the gym. I know a lot of people have told me they appreciate that, and it's something that they have encouraged us to do more of. And I want to encourage those people to support that, because it takes a lot of time and effort and actually money, bandwidth, the number of other costs that go along with streaming. And, you know, we have to pay that, and we want to make the service available and expand it, but we need you to support it. So please make your pledge call now, 217-244-9455, if you appreciate the streaming service, or go to the website, WILL.UIUC.edu, and please make a web pledge. That would make me feel really good, you know, because then I know people are really responding. They're using the site and are willing to support it. Mm-hmm. The thing that you mentioned, and we'll go out to Tom in a minute because I want to get an update on where we stand with the pledge totals, is this thing called podcasting. Now, people around Champaign-Urbana may have seen an article in the News Gazette on Monday in the circuit section about podcasting. And it's simply a way for users to subscribe to certain information sources on the web through a program that could, it's an RSS feed reader is technically what it's called. RSS stands for Really Simple Syndication. And we're about to use a bunch of buzzwords and acronyms. So, you know, language alert here, folks, technical language, that is. And basically what it does is allows you to subscribe to an MP3 feed so that every day you get the MP3 files from that source. So you basically punch in an address of the website that has this RSS feed that encloses an MP3 file, and it automatically goes to your computer every day. You don't have to do a thing. And if you have your iPod attached to your computer or another portable music player device, it will download the file into your portable player automatically. So you can just grab it and go wherever you want and listen to it in your own manner, in your own time. So this is a thing that we're starting to do. And we put a link up this week, in fact, on the Focus 580 page. I'm going to add it to the afternoon magazine pages. We'll probably do it for agriculture, for media matters, and another number of other shows, so you could actually subscribe and get these things without having to really think about it. So, you know, another way we're trying to improve the service and serve people better.
I'm just an analog guy in a digital world.
Yeah,
I'm feeling lost. But
we'll guide you through it, David.
I appreciate that. I'm looking to younger people like you to help me out.
Yes. Well, there's some actually on the page where we put this stuff. There's a, you know, on our site, there's an RSS page which you can get to from the homepage. The address will.uac.edu/RSS. That'll get you to that. And it has some good sort of tutorial resources and other kinds of information that if you're totally new to it, you're like, what is this? Come on. It's another acronym for something on the web. Just what we needed, right? You can get some good help, and it's some really good basic sort of descriptions of what it's all about. And it really is useful for folks. Now, here's an example. WGBH, which is one of the premier public broadcasting stations in the country, in Boston, they started podcasting the weekly show American Stories. Now, the first week that they started offering this podcast feed, they had 30 downloads. But by December, they had 57,000 downloads for the month.
Wow.
So a lot of people are using this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is still kind of in the early adopter phase of the technology. But as people discover how useful it is, like TiVo, okay? TiVo was something, oh, yeah, sure, I'm going to, you know, just tell my television to record my programs and, you know, then I can come and watch them anytime I want. Well, that's just a fancy VCR, except it's programmable and it's much better quality. And you can just, you know, like scan your TV guide and tell it, I want these programs. It'll go out there and get them. Podcasting is the same way. It's like TiVo for your radio. So yeah. I think it's going to catch on. And from what we're seeing in terms of use, it's very, very fast.
Well, I know that over the years, that's one of the questions we've gotten a lot from people. They've said, look, I'd like to listen to Focus 580 or their particular programs that I'd like to hear. Just mm-hmm. for example, for talking about Focus 580. And they'd said, but I can't be listening to the radio
right.
then. Is there some device that I could go out and buy that I could set – mm-hmm. like you set the VCR that says, okay, record this program Wednesday at 10 o'clock. And it was possible, but it was not easy.
Right. Now it's easy.
Now it's easy.
With a PC, a Mac, a Linux, a Unix box, whatever, there's this program called iPodder, which is free. You can download it at iPodder.com. And it basically gives you the scheduling abilities to say, I want this feed. And you can say every 12 hours, you can specify a particular time a day to go out and check the feed. If there's a new MP3 file that you can download, it'll do it automatically. It doesn't cost a thing. And it's very, very easy to use. I installed it in about 30 seconds. Anyone with a computer can do that.
Okay. Well, that is just one of the ways that we're looking for as many different ways to try to get programming to the people that we possibly can. And this is a new one, which we're doing. Of course, you can still use the old-fashioned way, and you can turn on your AM radio, and
right.
you can pick up your telephone, and you can call in and ask questions. But the bottom line here is, see, we need your financial support to continue to do what we've been doing all along, to look for new things to do. The money has to come from someplace, and now half of it really has to come from people who listen. So if you're not a financial supporter of the station, now is the time. Why don't we bring Tom into the – oh, poor Tom's been in Pled Central. Been
oh, help. Oh, hi.
Oh, Tom's in really –
oh, he went out for coffee.
This has been a fascinating conversation.
Okay.
Well, technically savvy guy, our news director, and so we hope that we can get the phones ringing. I see we've got some open lines in our Pledge Center, 217-244-9455. Where do we stand right now, Tom?
Plenty of open lines right now.
Okay.
I'd like to say thanks, first of all, because up to now we've had 93 new friends at WILL calling in since the pledge drive began over the weekend. 93 people who are coming back to AM 580 to say, you know, all this innovation that you're doing is worth my financial support. I want to see it keep going. Or people who have just not done it before, people who have discovered the station for the first time. And we say thank you to all of you who are just coming into the AM 580 fold and becoming a friend of WILL. 93 so far, 365 pledges overall through the week so far, but we want to pick up the pace. 244-9455 is how you get your financial contribution into AM 580. We've raised more than $32,000. We would like to, by the end of the week, get to $115,000. So it's very important that you take this opportunity between now and the end of the week. Sooner the better. How about right now? 217-244-9455. 9455, or as Jack mentioned, if you listen online, if you appreciate the fact that you can pick up Focus 580 and other programs whenever, go to WILL.UIUC.edu, where you can find all those programs. Click the link that says Pledge Now, and you can make that contribution as soon as possible. Or, of course, our fine volunteers who are starting to pick up the pace a little bit and can take your call right now at 244-9455.
Now, I want to say something about the economic model of public broadcasting and public broadcasting on the web. Some people have suggested that since we've begun streaming and offering archives for people to download or listen to on the web, we ought to charge people for that, that we ought to make them log in with a username and a password and a credit card number in order to get our archives.
That's a pretty usual business model, actually.
Right. But you know what? I think that's a terrible idea for public broadcasting, because what we're doing is we're serving the informational needs of a democracy. We're providing news and public affairs for people to understand their world, regardless of their ability to pay or their wealth. And what we need to do on the web is the same thing we do on the air. We say, look, we are going to provide this service for the community so that you can continue to understand your world, lifelong learning, citizenship information, all the things that you need as a member of the community and as a voting-informed citizen. So we want to be able to do that on the web as well, and say to you, if you value that, we need your support. I mean, we're not going to charge you for it, but we want you to voluntarily come back and say, here's my contribution. So please do that now.
This is radio on the honor system. It's a business model, as you mentioned, that we've been following ever since public radio began 30, 35, 40 years ago. It's important that you step up and help contribute to the programming that we put on every day. Make that call now, 217-244-9455.
Thank you very much, Tom and Jack, and we will talk some more later. I do want to thank here a couple of longtime supporters of AM 580. Our programs are made possible with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Also, the broadcast today is made possible by a grant from REMAX Realty Associates, currently handling over 30% of the real estate sales transactions in Champaign County. Information at 352-5700. REMAX encourages you to join them in supporting public broadcasting. Later today, as part of the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn will talk with travel guru Rick Steves. He's the host of a popular travel series on public television. He's the author of 28 best-selling European travel guidebooks, including Europe Through the Back Door. That title expresses his travel philosophy. Get off the beaten path and make some new friends, and he'll talk with Celeste following the 1 o'clock news here on AM 580. We're going to take a break. As usual, we'll have news at 1 minute past the hour. First, an update on the markets.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
And with this update on the markets now at 10:59 Central Time, I'm Jay Pierce. Good morning. March wheat on the Chicago Board of Trade at 2:09.